Welcome to Irish America Magazine. I'm Patricia Harty, the editor and co-founder of the magazine, which has been serving the Irish American community for 35 years. My guest today is Cormac O'Malley. Cormac was born in Ireland, but came to the US to live with his American-born mother, artist Helen Tucker, when his father died in 1957. And apart from his career, as an international corporate lawyer, Cormac has focused on the literary and artistic heritage of his parents, including the publication of books not published during their lifetimes. He's also been doing a wonderful series of podcasts, reading from and talking about his father, Ernie O'Malley's memoirs, On Another Man's Wound and The Singing Flame. On Another Man's Wound covers Ernie's participation in the War of Independence. At 23, he was the IRA commander general, commandant general, leading 7,000 volunteers, and later IRA senior commander during the Civil War, which is covered in The Singing Flame. Cormac has a new book out now with Harry Martin called Ernie O'Malley, A Life. Cormac, thank you very much for being with us here today. Can you start now and just give us some background on your father?
So my father was born in the west of Ireland, came to Dublin, and became involved in aspirations for independence in 1916. And, you know, there were two movements coming up to that period. One, the constitutional one, which is home rule might be good enough, and we were just like the any other colony, like Canada or Australia, or the people who wanted to be total independent and have a republic. And of course, the British wouldn't have a republic within the Commonwealth because they hadn't come to the sophisticated stage that they did later on during their empire rulings in the 40s and 50s and 60s, when a lot of the colonies became independent and indeed republics. So the issue for those who felt strongly on the nationalists and were willing to raise an army, basically, is what the IRA was, the Irish Volunteers turned into when the Parliament came into power in January 1919. It became the Army of the Republic, which was then declared. My father, as a 20-year-old, left home, started volunteering for Michael Collins, and Richard Mulcahy was sent all around the country to do their bidding in terms of helping organize fairly unorganized brigades. And the structure of the IRA at that time, you can't really think of it as an army. It was 65 separate brigades, and they were all with feeds and lines of communication into Dublin. Eventually, it got reorganized into 12 divisions. So there was a growth within the army, also within the people. Their people started to accept, particularly after 1919 and the elections of the Sinn Féin in 1918, people sort of said, maybe there really is something that we should take the one step further to have a republic rather than settling for home rule. So the war goes on for 2 years, and the question is whether the IRA were winning the war. People like my father and the other division commanders who were down the countryside felt they were definitely winning the war. They saw the results on the field. They saw that the RIC barracks were being attacked and evacuated, that they were getting ammunition and rifles, and they were preparing a real army, and they were training their men to do and take on the British Empire. And so when the truce came in July 1921, there was a real question mark hanging over the combatants as to why there was a truce. And people like my father felt this, there was some treachery going on, very suspicious. He was delighted that there was going to be a period of time where they could continue to train and get more arms and be ready to pick up the fight again. It never crossed their mind that this would end in a peaceful solution. So what happened in on December 7 or December 6, as it's called, was after the negotiations in London, The plenipotentiaries who were sent over there, with a limitation by De Valera that they should not sign anything without his approval, given the circumstances that Dev wasn't available because he was down in Limerick, and that there was pressure on those that party to sign that night or else face immediate and terrible war. Now, what was at stake? There was a treaty that had been negotiated. It gave Ireland, in effect, dominion status without having to fight further for it. So they were going to get the status that Canada had and Australia had. From the nationalist perspective, however, there was one basic flaw. Canada and Australia were inhabited, apart from indigenous people, were inhabited by Englishmen who went out, maybe French in Canada. In Ireland, the British had come in and had conquered the island. And so for 8 centuries, there had been a resistance against British rule. And that fed into nationalism. So what happened, the reaction to that this treaty, which gave cut off the 6 counties from the 26 counties, gave the British control over Irish ports. They did establish a boundary commission, but Ireland was no longer going to be a republic. It was no longer going to have the 32 counties, which is what the Republic technically had. No one was really able to control the politics in the northern 6 counties after 1920. But again, the Republican view wasn't there. So for the Republicans, this whole treaty was going the wrong side. Now, let's look at the historical facts of what happened that treaty. First of all, it was signed. So bingo, plenipotentiaries who have authority to sign at international law signed it. Secondly, that treaty came back to the cabinet in Dublin, and 4-3, it was approved. Thirdly, in the legislative arm of the Irish government, namely the Dáil, they approved it 64-57. And a couple of months later, you could say that in the elections of June, again, the people approved it. So what was happening in Ireland is that part of nationalist rhetoric was no longer being upheld by the people. They had been a little bit fed up between 1916 and 1921. They really weren't willing to go to another war. Now, on the Republican side, what had happened immediately after, in terms of reactions, my father writes very beautifully in The Singing Flame about just sitting down and crying when he read the articles of the treaty in the newspaper. He was down near Limerick in his command area. And they had no idea. I mean, this was something that Mick Collins had slipped one over on them. Michael Collins was their beloved boss. He spoke readily about what should be done. And even in The Singing Flame, Father says he went in and talked to Collins and to Owen O'Duffy, senior people in the IRA at the time. And he said, yes, I've seen them. I met with him and Owen O'Duffy. They said that the treaty would give us breathing space, allow the army to arm and equip, and then we could declare war whenever a suitable opportunity came. So he's quoting Michael Collins. Collins is trying to calm down the Republicans and try to get them back on board because out of the 12 Cumannagh generals, who are all fairly young, each in charge of a division around Ireland, you know, 7 or 8 of them were against the treaty. So that means on a command structure within the IRA, quite apart from the rank and file, you know, the regional commanders who had won the war, in their view, and scare the British into making a settlement, were no longer going to be accepted. And so there was an immediate reaction by those people to what the forthcoming events were going to be. And there's, I mean, the tragedy of the treaty is that on the day that Ireland gets its almost independence, quasi-independence in the form of a colonial settlement, it also sets the seeds for civil war, which is going to occur within 6 months by its actual deadline. But you can see within 4 or 5 days of that treaty signing, the dissension within the party.
Cormac, did your father, did Ernie attend the treaty debate in Dáil Éireann?
So one of the things that my father did is during the treaty debates, several interesting things occurred. One was he went up to Dublin from Mayo, from Tipperary to find out what was going on. And during the debates, he came in and he saw Richard Mulcahy. Richard Mulcahy had been a medical student with father, rose to the ranks and became chief of staff of the IRA. And my father had reported to him directly when first went on the run in 1918. So they were well known to each other. And he asked my father how was he going to vote on the treaty. And Mulcahy explains to him he had two allegiances. One to the people who voted him, whom he is representing in Parliament, and the other is the Chief of Staff. And he said on the divide of these two issues, he was going to have to go with what the people wanted, at least what he interpreted the people wanted. So my father immediately, as a brash, he's 24 years old, offers his resignation and said, that's not the army I want to fight in. And Mulcahy refuses that. Now, there's another story just about the same time involving similar people, which is father goes into those meetings and he's not actually a parliamentarian, so he's just standing in the hallway. But he gives a letter to De Valera in saying that you have the military backing of the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Southern Divisions. Let's call it 21,000 men. So father hears the rumor that De Valera is going to offer a compromise. It's called document number two. Document number one is the treaty for purposes of discussion. And politicians then refer to the second document being offered to the debate as document number two. And in the famous document number two, De Valera works his magic in saying, it would be sufficient if we can have some form of external association with the British Empire. So Dev was trying to work, who was the actual president at the time that he made those statements. He was actually president of the Republic because the sides had not split yet. And he was willing to make that compromise. And the diehards like Ernie O'Malley and Liam Lynch and others said, no, there will be never any association with the British Empire. We are Republicans and we want to remain so. So my father's dislike of De Valera starts from that period when he was willing to compromise what the Republicans started for. And another little incident, which was, you know, Ginger O'Connell, who was the number two in the army, the assistant to the chief of staff, good friend of my father's, head of training and various other things. They had worked on missions together over a period of years. And he came up to see Ginger O'Connell. And Ginger asks him, how many men will you give our new army? And my father says, you forgot that you took an oath. And if you want my men to serve you, you will have to fight for them. We're talking about the month of December, several days after the signing of the treaty. And so it was quite clear, not what the future really would be, but that there was a major divide amongst the senior people in the IRA.
And of course, the Civil War then was just such a horrendous time in Irish history, because he was fighting against not the British Army, but but you know, colleagues who had he had fought in the War of Independence. Can you talk a little bit about what happened to him during the Civil War? I know that he went on hunger strike and he was arrested and he was tortured, and it was really such a brutal. On Another Man's Wound is such a hopeful book in a way. It's so beautifully written, and he talks about the countryside, and it's so evocative, and there's so much hope, and so much hope in the people. And then The Singing Flame is the Civil War, and of course a lot of it happens when he's in prison, and it's a whole different story.
Yeah, I mean, the Civil War, none of the Republicans, even though they wanted, their aim was to keep the IRA together. And the question was, how could you possibly keep Republicans and non-Republicans together under the one flag, reporting to an individual? And there were different drafts of how that army should look. But the important part was, where was its allegiance going to be? Was it going to be, quote, a British army getting guns from Britain, or was it going to be an Irish army? So people like Father and Rory O'Connor, Rory O'Connor was the former Minister of Defense, and he became a senior sort of political conscience, and called meetings in Dublin and invited people like Michael Kilroy from Mayo. He was the officer in command of that division. Liam Lynch from Cork, Ernie O'Malley from the Tipperary 2nd Division. So they all came together and said, how can we keep our army together? And they went through various plans. Eventually, they didn't see how they could, because there was just essential split.
Cormac, can you take us now to June 28, 1922, which was really the start of the Irish Civil War, and the anti-treaty troops decided to occupy the Fort Court building in Dublin, and your father was, I believe, chief of operations.
And so what they did is they took over the forecourts militarily, and the forecourts was a very critical point. I mean, you were stopping the execution of law in this new Dominion state. The British didn't understand why the Irish governor, now Michael Collins, was allowing the courts to stop and having these Republicans come in. So eventually, things escalated. And one of the things we always know about Michael Collins is that he was a gamesman. And in my view of him, what happened, he was just playing with too many things and he couldn't control everything. And so little things like the assassination of Henry Wilson in London by his own men on his call. And he thought that that would help the situation, getting rid of a significant pro-North, pro-treaty would help in the British. And in fact, he was a former commander of the Imperial British Army. And of course, it had the opposite effect. Then they started kidnapping. And Father thought, well, okay, we'll kidnap Ginger O'Connell, the same man that I referred to earlier. Ginger O'Connell was Michael Collins's assistant chief of staff. And, you know, Churchill said, how can you allow your forecourts to be taken over and your assistant chief of staff to be kidnapped? Take action, bomb them. And so the difficult question that Collins had, would he bomb the forecourts or would he allow the British? And ultimately he said, it's my responsibility. I'm in charge of the government, I'll do it. And that was what triggered the Civil War in June 28, 1922. It was a very sad affair. It was poorly orchestrated by the Republicans. People like my father and Liam Lynch, Liam Lynch was the chief of staff. My father was the number two, the assistant chief of staff. They had no military training in terms of how to run a headquarters staff. They never used artillery. They were guerrilla masters at the guerrilla warfare, which had been successful in attacking RIC barracks and things like that, and knocking individuals off. and threatening people, but they didn't know how to have a campaign. And so they, sadly enough, the Free State had the, no doubt, advice from the Britain, and they sent ships around with troops into Cork and into Kerry and over into Galway. And they basically surrounded the island and invaded from the sea. And within 2 months, by mid-August, the battle was more or less over. And so, but, you know, the Republicans refused to give up. They said, you know, stiff upper lip and carry on. And there was no reality in their position. And indeed, in the biography of my father that Harry Martin has written, we have a marvelous quote from one of my father's directors of communications and later the Taoiseach of the Irish government, Sean Lamass. And he tells me in my interview with him in 1970, we all knew that the game was up by August. And so I said, well, why didn't it stop? And he said, well, you know, the leaders didn't feel that way. So it came down to a couple of leaders, senior leaders, who were able to stop their men thinking negatively about peace. But on my father's personal story, he was captured in very dramatic terms. There's an article in the Irish Independent of that Saturday afternoon, which says, this is the stuff that makes movies, where his house was surrounded and he was wounded 7 or 8 times and he was dragged out and almost shot then and brought to Portobello Barracks. And you know, he was a captive for the next 18 months and out of the running. But it was not until the two senior commanders, Ernie O'Malley and Liam Lynch, were either out of combat or dead, as Lynch was in April of 1923. It was only then that the Army Council of the IRA could change their vote. I think it became 5-4 and then 5-2 in favor of suing for peace, so to speak. And Frank Aiken, as the new chief of staff, told his men, lay down your arms and dump your arms and cease hostilities.
He was the last prisoner to be released, I believe.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, the Free State had a major problem on their hands. They had 12,000 anti-treaty men. Now, you know, I don't know what the prison population of Ireland is today, but 12,000 men, when you don't expect to have them, and they're housed all over the countryside, is a major issue in terms of feeding, in terms of maintaining them, in terms of doing whatever needs to be done. So they basically did not want to release senior managers of war like Ernie O'Malley until he had quietened down. Now, he was an invalid, so he couldn't have gone out fighting, but nevertheless, the attitude was keep the leaders till the end. And so he was certainly one of the last people to be allowed to depart the Curra internment camp in July 1924, long after the war had finished.
What does his life become then?
Well, you know, my father had a fascinating life because he had two big major sections. He had always been interested in the arts and literature. And of course, one of the things that he did in prison, he was in prison both under the British as well as under the Irish for over 20 months. So he did an awful lot of a university course in reading. And that prepared him for the rest of his life, which was a non-military life. He tried to become a professional doctor. He sort of gave that up. And he decided to write his memoirs, become a poet, become interested in the arts. He married my mother, who was an American sculptor. And it was only recently I came up with the conclusion as to why didn't he marry one of those Bonnie coming on the mon ladies from Tipperary or Dublin or whatever. And I came up with the conclusion, which was he just was sick of the war. Now, look, everything is circumstantial. So you meet the right person in our lives and things happen. But he was in America, and I'm sure he was delighted to meet somebody who knew nothing about Ireland, who knew nothing about guerrilla tactics, and was an artist. So he was had an entree into the new field of endeavor that he wanted to do. So when Ernie O'Malley married Helen Hooker, they returned to Ireland into a field of the arts. And my recent documentary called A Call to Arts, which is on Radio Television Éireann now and is available on Connecticut Public Television, is a 52-minute sort of history of what their artistic journey was and how they achieved it in photography. They both did marvelous photography of Ireland and ancient Ireland. And they thought that the idea of getting the Irish to acknowledge not what British paintings had been in the 19th century and early 20th century, but go back to the ethnic origins of Irish, the beauty of their historical monuments that they had, and enjoy and appreciate those. So he wanted to publish a book on photography of the magnificent monastic settings, the high crosses and the illuminated manuscripts and things like that. And my mother was an artist, so she was on the forefront of establishing the Irish Irish Living Artists exhibits in 1943. She created a theater in Dublin, and she insisted on paying her actors £1 a day in 1944, which was enough that they didn't need a second job. So they were on the forefront, the cutting edge of what was modern Ireland arts, and they supported it. And he befriended a lot of artists, from Jack Yates and Louis Labrocki, Mamie Jellett, Evie Hone. They were part of their family that they had in Dublin in the artistic circle. So he had an entirely second life, and he was very fortunate. He was able to write beautifully, as you mentioned, in On Another Man's Wound, but he was able to bring that acumen with words to the arts. So in his literary reviews of Jack Yates or Louis Labrocki or other artists that he was doing, he was able to explain art. He could paint words, so that whereas when you look at a painting, you see the visual quality. And when you look at an author's writing of a review of a painting, you can see it in a second dimension, which is literary rather than visual. And he had the talent to be able to do that.
I guess my question would be, if the nature of his work wasn't Republican, would he be remembered as a writer? He was such a, On Another Man's Wound is so evocative, his descriptions of the countryside, and I mean, he's such a lyrical writer.
Well, he never wrote a novel. But I'm in the process of editing his fiction. And so he wrote short stories or vignettes about some of these incidents. And they are so poignant, so moving of how these young men felt about the incidents that they were involved in. So had he not written his memoir, I think it'll be quite a surprise. He wrote his diaries, which I've published. He wrote significant letters. He wrote people, he helped people in the arts. So I think, though clearly having published a book, you know, how do you become known? So, and if you're not a professional. So publishing a book is one way to do it. He had published poetry in Ireland. He wasn't a painter, but he could, as I mentioned, paint with words. So and as an editor of the Bell magazine and of a person who was well known in the arts, I think he would have had a whole second life, even if he had not published that first book, On Another Man's Wound.
He also did an amazing group of interviews, right? He went to different counties and interviewed people who had been involved in the War of Independence and the struggle. Didn't you? Yeah. Bring out a book called Raids and Rallies?
Well, there were several, yes. He spent 4 years of a life, 5 years of his life from 1948 through 53, roaming around the country in a little car. Sometimes I was with him. sleeping under the car so we wouldn't impose on friends. And also, you know, the sand under a car was far better for his back than a lumpy country mattress, which would be quite painful for his battered back. Anyway, he spent those 5 years, he interviewed more than 450 people, and he formed a brotherhood, a blood bonding with these people that he wanted to get their story out. Now, this is happening in the 1946 to 53 period, at the same time that the Irish Military Bureau of History is being established. And what they do is they did 1,700 interviews, and they typed everything up and they sent it back to the person who was making the statement and had them re-edited, etc. But those statements were very formal. And what my father did in his own handwriting of over 2.5 million words, which he then rewrote in another 2.5 million words, was the very personal statements that came literally from their mouths rather than from a typewriter. And he thought that in this manner he could get the real truth. Now, the book that he wrote on raids and rallies, his task was then to reconcile the various statements made by people, and he put on his historian's hat as opposed to a biographical hat. And he had to adjudicate between the stories that he heard. And he gave the stories in Tipperary and the barracks raids and down in Renin and Carrickeely and other places. So he was playing his historical thing. Now, what happened when he died was all of these manuscripts were left unpublished.
Cormac, you were only 14 when your father passed away. Can you give me your memories of that time? Did you know of his role in the War of Independence and the Civil War?
I hadn't read his book, and I hadn't known that he was in IRA. So it came as quite a shock to me to go to Glasnevin, where we had the limousines pulled up, and we had a state funeral. Ernie O'Malley got the sixth state funeral in Irish history. And who was he? He was not a politician. He was not a president of the country, such as the other people. He was not Michael Collins, and he was not Griffith. So all of the other people who had gotten a state funeral were substantial characters. And I think what this reflects is, and I say quite ironically, that De Valera had always been a great admirer of my father, felt very badly that he could never get Ernie O'Malley back on board with the Sinn Féin attitude that my father had. And what he was doing in his death was honoring him. And De Valera had just come into power for yet another term, and Fianna Fáil and his comrades who were part of that cabinet at the time, they all said, well, let's give him a good send off anyway. So they had, we have photographs of De Valera and Lamass and Aiken, all in their very severe black coats, etc. They came out to Howth, and Shanti O'Kelly was there, and then up to Glasnevin. And I remember, I was quite shocked when these guns were fired off right over, I'd never seen this conduct before. And I went home and painted a little picture that night in the hotel of being shocked by this. I was just so stunned. Anyway, that was how he ended and how the state celebrated him. Would he have wanted a state funeral? Absolutely not. And certainly not from the Fianna Fáil party.
He questioned his political principles as life went on, or?
Well, if by that question you mean, did he change his strong feelings for Sinn Féin, and did he change his attitude toward taking up a gun or not? So I would say he still would have been a Sinn Féiner, But I don't think during the Second World War, what we call the emergency in Ireland, he actually volunteered to go into the Irish Army at the time, but he wasn't accepted. So, and it was that Irish Army and the political regime who were locking up the IRA and hanging, executing some of them. So I think as a practical matter, he would have left the gun on the table. And but still have had his political observations. Was he realistic enough to say that, look, Northern Ireland became its own government and was had its own army up there, and there was no way that the border campaign of 1956 was going to unseat an established army in the north? So I don't think he would have supported the border campaign in 56. It would be, and then extenuate that through 1969. Would he have been in favor of civil rights? Absolutely. Would he have been in favor of the more recent Republican activities? I don't have an answer for that. I think he might have thought it. He lost in the Civil War. This is a war against Ireland, and therefore he might have thought it as a losing cause. Would he have rejoiced in the peace agreement and what might eventually happen? Undoubtedly.
So can you tell me now about the latest book, about the new biography and how it came about and why you felt you wanted to have a complete life out there of?
Well, Harry Martin, a friend of mine here in Stonington, Connecticut, listened to one of my lectures and heard me babble on about my father. And he just became very excited by this quite, in his view, exotic character who put his courage on the line, who would feel strongly about any of the issues that he wanted to pursue and fought for them till the end. And being when he was put out of the war in the Civil War. And then he had this such incredible artistic life afterward during his travels in America, going out west and meeting the photographers in the art world, Edward Weston and Paul Strand and George O'Keefe and Alfred Stieglitz, and visiting in Taos, New Mexico with artists there, and then going down to Mexico for 8 months. Living, and he was fascinated in Mexico because here was a country that had just had a revolution in 1917 and started to do exactly what father wanted to do, which was bring indigenous qualities into the art. And Mexico was rejecting the establishment of art, which was pro-Spanish and very formal and portraitures. And Diego Rivera came and just changed all of that, knocked it on its ass, so to speak. And the other artists who came along. And father felt very much in favor of that. When he went back, he was encouraging, you know, the Mamie Jellets and the Louis Libraques to, and Louis did not have any formal training, but he said, express yourself and go out and see what Ireland is. He introduced them to the tinkers, what we call the travelers today, people who had probably not been painted about before. And so he was bringing the native materials of Ireland to the fore. So, He floated. He was in the Irish Pavilion and the World's Fair in Chicago in 1933. He knew a fantastic group of people. In the meantime, he was publishing, trying to write his book. He got into the Yada Foundation in Saratoga Springs, where he had given room and board for 6 weeks to finish his book. He got published as a poet in the Poetry magazine in Chicago. And so he was developing himself as a whole new makeup for what he was going to be. And so I think he was really very satisfied with what he had become and what he would then be able to contribute to Ireland in the background for artistic endeavors. Great. Now, the book tells about that journey, and it's called A Life. And it's a very lively characterization of what fathers loves with my father, with my mother, and life in around, and his friendships. So I think Harry Martin has done a fine job in bringing a man to life, really. It's not an academic book with heavy footnotes, etc. There are plenty of footnotes, which I helped to make sure got in there so that if people want to get them, they are. But the point is, it's a good read. It's a life of endeavor, of someone who felt deeply about something and followed through throughout his life. And it's a very sad book because his, you know, at the end, my mother leaves him. My mother takes my brother and sister away from him. He's in poor health. He's had, we live in poor circumstances in Ireland. And he, you know, was hospitalized with a heart attack. So he certainly went downhill fairly rapidly, and he dies at age 59, which is far too young.
Absolutely. But a fascinating man. And I would just really recommend, if you want to know anything about the War of Independence or the Civil War, or indeed why we are the way we are in Ireland, also about the beauty of Ireland and why after 800 years we still have that spirit that's uniquely different, I recommend that you read those books. So Cormac, thank you so much for being with us today.
And my pleasure, as always, Trish.
Okay. Okay.
Bye.